In the early morning of the next day, the hunting party disembarked on the bank of the river below the village of Dubba. Then all the horses and 20 chariots were offloaded from the small convoy of lighters and galleys. While this was being done, the lance-bearers sharpened the spear-blades, restrung the hunting bows, and checked the arrows for balance and straightness. While the horses were watered, fed and groomed, the hunters ate a hearty breakfast that the villagers had provided. The mood was ebullient, and Apepe sent for the tracker who had returned from the hills to report.
"It is a very big lion, the biggest I have ever seen east of the river," the man told them, increasing their excitement.
"You actually saw him?" Nefer demanded. "Or did you only read his sign?"
"I saw him clearly, but only at a distance. He stands as tall as a horse, and he walks with the dignified tread of a monarch. His mane waves like a sheaf of durra millet stalks in the wind."
"By Seth, the fellow is a poet," Narja sneered. "Stick to the facts and eschew the fine words, Nape."
The huntsman touched his heart with his fist to show his contrition, and went on with his report in a subdued tone.
"He lay up yesterday in a wooded wadi, 2 leagues from here, but he left at the fall of night to prowl. It is 4 days since he last fed, and he's hungry and hunting again. During the night he tried to drag down an oryx, but it kicked him off and ran free."
"Where do you hope to find him today?"
Nefer asked in a kinder voice than Narja had used.
"If he hunted, he'll be thirsty as well as hungry. Where will he drink?"
The huntsman looked at him with respect, not only for his royal eminence, but also for the knowledge of the wild he displayed.
"After his attempt to bring down the oryx, he went into stony ground where we could no longer read his tracks."
Apepe made a gesture of annoyance, and the huntsman hurried on.
"But I expect him to have drunk this morning at a small oasis, a little hidden place, little known to any except the Bedouin."
"How long to reach this place?"
Nefer asked, and the man swept his arm through part of an arc, indicating the sun's progress over the passage of 3 hours.
"Well, then we have little time to waste."
Nefer smiled at him and turned away to shout at the troop captain of the chariots.
"How much longer, soldier?"
"All is ready, Majesty."
"Sound the mount up,"
Nefer ordered, and the ram's horns blared as the hunters scattered to the waiting chariots. Mintaka walked at Nefer's side. In these informal circumstances, all royal dignity was forgotten, and they were simply boy and girl on an exciting outing. Lord Trock spoiled the illusion. Just as he leapt into his own chariot and gathered up the reins, he called across to King Apepe,
"Your Majesty, it's not wise to let the princess ride with an untried boy. This is not a gazelle we're hunting now."
Nefer froze and stared at Trock with outrage. Mintaka laid a small hand on his bare arm.
"Do not provoke him. He's a formidable fighter with a terrible temper. If you challenge him, even your rank will not protect you."
Nefer shrugged off her arm furiously.
"My honour will not allow me to ignore such an insult. Please, my heart, for my sake, let it pass."
It was the first time she had used such an endearment. She did it deliberately, knowing the effect it must have on him. She was already learning to manage his volatile moods and tempers with a loving woman's instinct far beyond her years and experience. In the instant, Nefer forgot Trock and the slur to his honour.
"What did you call me?"
he asked huskily.
"You're not deaf, my darling."
He blinked at this second endearment.
"You heard quite clearly."
And she smiled into his face. Apepe bawled into the silence.
"Don't worry, Trock. I'm sending my daughter to take care of Pharaoh. He will be quite safe."
He gave a snort of laughter and shook the reins. As his team jumped forward, he shouted again,
"We've wasted half the morning here. Huntsman, take up the chase."
Nefer steered his chariot behind Apepe, cutting steeply past the noses of Lord Trock's team. As he went by, he gave Trock a cold stare and told him,
"You're impudent. Rest assured that this is not the end of it.
We will speak further on this matter, Lord Trock.
I fear he's now your enemy, Nefer,
Mintaka murmured.
Trock has an evil reputation and an even more evil temper.
Led by the royal huntsman, who rode bareback astride a scrubby but tough little pony, the hunting column climbed into the bare stony hills. They went at a trot, saving the horses, letting them blow after every steep gradient. Within the hour, they found one of the Nubian trackers waiting for them on a hilltop, and he ran down to report to the huntsman. They spoke to each other earnestly. Then the huntsman trotted back to report to the royal party.
The Nubians have cast the hills, but without finding the spoor again. They're sure that he'll drink at the waterhole, but not wanting to disturb him, they've waited for us to catch up. Lead us to the water,
Apepi ordered, and on they went. Before midday they came down into a shallow valley. They were not far from the river, but this seemed like the deep desert, waterless and forbidding. The huntsman trotted alongside Apepi's chariot and said,
"The water holds at the head of this valley. The beast'll probably be lying up nearby."
Naturally, Apepi, the old warrior, took command, and Nefer did not dispute his right to do so.
"We'll split into three squadrons and surround the oasis. If the chase breaks cover, we'll have him surrounded. My Lord Regent, do you take the left wing? Pharaoh Nefersetti, take the centre. I will cover the right flank."
He brandished his heavy war bow over his head.
"Whoever draws first blood will win the trophy."
They were all expert charioteers, and the new formation evolved swiftly and without check. They threw out a wide net to encircle the waterhole. Nefer had his bow over his shoulder and the reins unwrapped from his wrists, ready to drop them in an instant to leave both hands free to draw. Mintaka pressed close to his side. She held the long lance ready to hand to him. They'd perfected this change of weapons over the past weeks, and he knew he could rely upon her to slap the grip of the lance into his palm at the very moment he needed it. They approached the oasis at a walk, closing in steadily. The horses sensed the tension in their drivers, and perhaps they'd picked up the lion's scent. They flung up their heads and rolled their eyes and blew through their nostrils, stepping high and nervously. The line of vehicles closed slowly round the patch of low scrub and rank grass that concealed the waterhole. When the encirclement was complete, Apepi raised his hand above his head to signal a halt. The royal huntsman dismounted and went forward on foot, leading his pony. He approached the sparse brown cover cautiously.
"If the lion was here, surely we would have seen such a large animal by now."
Mintaka's voice shook, and Nefer loved her all the more for this little show of fear.
"A lion can flatten himself until he becomes part of the earth, and you could walk close enough to touch him without ever suspecting his presence," he told her.
The huntsman went forward a few paces at a time, stopping to listen and search every bush and clump of rank grass in his path. On the edge of the scrub, he stooped and picked up a handful of small stones and began to lob them systematically at each possible hiding place.
"What's he doing?" Mintaka whispered. "The lion will growl before it charges. He's trying to provoke it and make it reveal itself."
The silence was broken only by the plop of the pebbles, the snorting of the horses, and the relentless stamping of their hooves. Every one of the hunters had knocked an arrow and was poised to draw at an instant. Suddenly there was a squawk and clatter in the grass. Every bow bent up at once, and the lance-bearers hefted their weapons. They all relaxed and looked sheepish, as a chocolate-brown hammerhead stork launched itself into the air and flapped away down the valley in the direction of the river. The huntsman took a minute to recover his nerve, then began to work his way, a pace at a time, deeper into the cover, until he reached the seep. The brackish water came up, a sluggish drop at a time, and filled a shallow basin in the rocky ground, hardly enough to quench the thirst of a great predator. The huntsman went down on one knee to search the rim of the basin for sign, then shook his head and stood up. More quickly he worked back through the scrub, and at last mounted the pony and trotted back to Apepi's chariot. The other hunters drove across to hear his report, but the huntsman was crestfallen.
"Majesty, I was mistaken in my judgment," he told Apepi. "The lion has not come this way."
"Well, what now, fellow?"
Apepi was making no effort to hide his disappointment and irritation.
"Well, this was the most promising place to look, but there are others. From where we last saw him, he could have crossed the valley, or he may be lying up close to here and waiting for darkness before drinking. There is cover further down." He pointed back to the stony slopes.
"Where else?" Apepi demanded.
"Oh, there's another waterhole in the next valley, but there are Bedouin encamped there. They might have scared off the beast. There's another small water seep below these hills to the west." He pointed out a low line of purple peaks on the horizon. "The lion could be at any of these places, or at none," the man admitted. "Also, he might have doubled back and be on the edge of the plain, where there's an abundance of water. Perhaps he's been drawn by the smell of cattle and goats as well as by thirst."
"You have not the least idea where he's hiding, have you?" Lord Narja demanded. "We should call off the hunt and go back to the boats."
"No,"
Nefer cut in.
"We've barely begun. How can we give up so soon?"
"The boy's right," Apepi agreed. "We must go on, but there's much ground to cover."
He paused for a moment, then reached a decision.
"We have to split up and search each area separately." He looked across at Narja. "My Lord Regent, you take your squadron to the Bedouin encampment. If they've seen the chase, they'll direct you. I'll ride to the seep below the hills."
He turned to Trok.
"Take 3 chariots down to the valley. One of the trackers will go with you and search for sign." To Asmore he said, "Take 3 chariots and cast back along the edge of the plain to Dubba, in case he's returned to where he last killed." Then he looked at Nefer. "Pharaoh, you cast in the opposite direction, north, towards Akmim."
Nefer realized that he was being given the least promising ground to cover, but he had no complaint. This new plan meant that for the first time he and Mintaka would be away from the direct surveillance of his guardians. Narja, Asmore, and Trok were being sent in different directions. He waited for someone to point this out, but they were all so wrapped up in the hunt that no one seemed to realize the significance of this move, except Narja. He looked hard at Nefer. Perhaps he was weighing the advisability of countermanding Apepi's orders. But in the end he must have realized that this would be unwise, and concluded that Nefer was guarded by the desert as effectively as he would have been by Asmore. There was no place for him to run to, and if he took Mintaka with him on some wild adventure, he would have the entire armies of both kingdoms upon him like swarms of wild bees. Narja looked away from him as Apepi went on to nominate an assembly point and to give his final orders. At last the ram's horn sounded the mount up and the advance, and the 5 columns drove out of the valley. On the level ground they split into their separate squadrons and headed out in diverging directions. As the last of the other squadrons disappeared around the stark hills, Mintaka leant even closer to Nefer and murmured,
"At last, Hathor has shown mercy to us."
"I believe it's Horus who has granted us the favour," Nefer grinned at her. "But I'll accept this benevolence from whomsoever it comes."
There were 2 other chariots in Nefer's squadron, commanded by Colonel Hilto, the old soldier who had discovered him and Taito when they'd tried to escape from Egypt. He'd served under Nefer's father and was loyal unto death. Nefer knew that he could trust him without reservation. Nefer led them fast, wanting to make the most of the remaining daylight, and within an hour's ride the vast vista of the river plain opened beneath them. He reined in to admire it for a few minutes. The river was an emerald, mounted in the luscious green of fields and plantations that enclosed it.
"How beautiful it is, Nefer,"
Mintaka spoke almost dreamily.
"Even when we're married, we must always remember that this land owns us.
and that we do not own it. Sometimes he forgot that she'd been born in Avaris and had as strong a claim to the land as he had. He felt his heart swell with pride that she loved it as he did, and felt the same patriotic duty. "I'll never forget it. Not with you at my side." She lifted her face to him, and her lips were parted slightly. He could smell her sweet breath, and the temptation to reach down for those lips with his own mouth was almost irresistible. Then he caught the glance of Hilto and the other men on them, and from the corner of his eye he saw one smile knowingly. He drew back and looked at Hilto coolly. He'd been rehearsing his next order since they had left the rest of the hunting party. "Colonel, if the lion is here, he'll probably be lying up somewhere in the slope of the hills down below us." He indicated the area with a sweep of his arm. "I want to extend in line abreast. The left flank must be on the edge of the plain, and our right up here on the crest of the hills. We'll sweep northwards." He made a wide gesture, but Hilto looked dubious and scratched the scar on his cheek. "It's a broad front, Your Majesty. It's almost half a league to the valley bottom. At times we'll be out of sight of each other." Neffer could see that it went against all his military instincts to spread his front too thin, and he went on swiftly to mollify him. "If we do become separated, we'll reassemble on the third ridge ahead of us, under that small hillock over there. It'll give us a good landmark." He pointed out a distinctive rock pile 4 miles ahead. "If any of us is late to the rendezvous, the others must wait until the sun is at that angle before coming back to look for the missing vehicle." He had given himself a few hours before they would begin to search for him and Mintaka. Still, Hilto hesitated. "I beg Your Majesty's indulgence, but the Lord Naja charged me most strictly," Effer cut in with a sharp tone and cold expression, "to presume to argue with your Pharaoh."
"Never, Majesty."
Hilto was shocked at the accusation.
"And do your duty, fellow."
Hilto saluted with deep respect and hurried back to his own chariot, shouting urgent orders to his men as he ran. As the squadron wheeled out off down the slope, Mintaka nudged Neffer and said, "Do your duty, fellow." She mimicked his haughty tone, then laughed. "Please never look at me like that, or use that tone to me, Your Majesty. I'm sure I would die of fright." "We have only a little time," he replied. "We must make the most of it, and find a place where we can be alone." He swung the chariot back over the skyline so that they could no longer be seen from the river valley, or by the chariots lower down the slope. As they trotted forward, they were both craning eagerly ahead.
"Look, over there!"
Mintaka pointed to the right. A small grove of thorn trees was almost hidden by a fold in the ground, only the dull green tops showing. Neffer turned towards it, and they found a narrow ravine that had been cut over millennia into the hillside by wind and weather and rare thunderstorms. There must have been subterranean water, for the thorn trees were robust. Their thick foliage offered shade and privacy in this hot midday. Neffer drove down the bank and into the shade. As soon as he stopped, Mintaka hopped down from the footplate.
"Loosen the harness and give the horses a rest," she suggested.
Neffer hesitated, then shook his head. It was against his training. In a detached and unsupported position such as this, he must have the vehicle ready for any sudden alarm or excursion. He jumped down and went to fill the bucket from the water skin to water the horses. Mintaka came to help him. They worked side by side in silence. Now that the moment they had both longed for had arrived, they were shy and tongue-tied. Suddenly they turned to each other simultaneously and spoke in unison. Neffer said,
"I wanted to tell you..."
Mintaka said,
"I think that we should..."
They stopped and laughed shyly, standing close together in the shade. Mintaka blushed and looked down at her feet, and Neffer stroked the head of his stallion.
"What were you going to say?" "Oh, it was nothing. Nothing important."
She shook her head, and he saw that she was blushing. He so loved to watch the colour bloom in her cheeks. She was still not looking at him, and her voice was so soft as to be barely audible. She asked in her turn,
"What were you going to say?"
"When I think that you'll be gone in just a few more days' time, I feel as though my right arm has been cut off and I want to die."
"Oh, never."
She looked up at him, and her eyes were huge and liquid with the turmoil and rapture of first love.
"I love you. I do truly love you."
In the same instant, they both lunged for each other and their teeth came together with a click. His lower lip was caught between them, and a drop of blood oozed from the nick. So their kiss was salt-flavoured. Their embrace was unpracticed and unrehearsed, clumsy and frenzied. It evoked wild and uncontrolled feelings in both of them. They clung together, moaning with the strength of these new sensations. Even though her body was flattened against his, he tried to pull her closer still, while she clung harder as though to weld their separate flesh into one entity, like potter's clay. She reached up and twisted her fingers into his thick, dusty curls and said, "Oh, no." But her voice was blurred.
"I don't want to lose you,"
he broke the kiss.
"I never want to lose you. I don't want to leave you, ever, ever."
And they kissed again, if possible, even more furiously than before. From here onwards, they were in unexplored realms of body and mind. They rode together on a chariot that was out of their control, drawn by runaway horses of love and desire. Still clinging together, they sank down on the soft white sand of the wadi bottom and clawed at each other's bodies as though they were enemies. Their eyes were wild and unseeing, their breath ragged and broken. The linen of her skirt tore like papyrus parchment in his hands, and he reached through the opening. She moaned as though in mortal agony, but her thighs fell apart and she went limp and pliable. Neither had any inkling of where this was leading. All Never wanted to do was to feel his bare skin against her smoothness. It was a deep need on which his very life seemed to depend. He ripped away his own apron, and they pressed their bodies together, both absorbed in the ecstatic sensation of her warm young flesh against his hardness. Then, without any conscious thought, he began to move against her, rocking rhythmically, and she rode his movements as though they were flying in a chariot over rough ground. Then abruptly she felt something hard pressing imperiously at the very portals of her womanhood, and she experienced the almost undeniable urge to meet thrust with thrust, to help him break through, to welcome him into her soft, secret places. Then reality rushed back at her. She kicked out wildly, arching her back and struggling with renewed strength like a gazelle in the jaws of a hunting cheetah. She tore her mouth from his and screamed, "No, never! You promised! By Horus's wounded eye, you promised!" He sprang away from her, recoiling as though from a slash with a chariot whip. He stared at her with wide and terrified eyes. His voice was hoarse and panting, as though he'd run far and fast.
"Mintaka, my love, my darling, I don't know what happened to me. It was a madness. I did not intend it."
He made a despairing gesture.
"I would rather die than break my oath and bring dishonor upon you."
His breathing was so labored that she could not answer him at once. She averted her eyes from his naked body, and he went on piteously,
"Please, don't hate me. I did not know what was happening. I don't hate you, Nefer. I could never hate you."
His distress was too much to bear. She wanted to throw herself back into his arms and to comfort him, but she knew how dangerous that would be. She used the wheel of the chariot to pull herself to her feet.
"I'm as much at fault as you are. I should never have let that happen."
Her legs trembled under her, and she tried to push her hair back off her face with both hands. He stood up guiltily, took one step towards her, but when she recoiled, he stopped at once.
"I've torn your skirt," he said.
"I did not mean to." She looked down and saw how blatantly she was exposed. She was almost as naked as he was. Hastily, she pulled the ripped ends together and stepped further from him.
"You must dress yourself,"
she whispered, and despite herself, she looked down at him. It was so lovely, and she felt desire rise again. She forced herself to look away. He stooped quickly, gathered up the discarded chiton, and fastened it round his waist. They stood in guilty, awkward silence. Desperately, Mintaka searched for words to distract them both from this terrible moment. Her own body came to her aid. She became aware of a real and pressing fullness in her bladder.
"I must go. No,"
he pleaded.
I did not mean it. Forgive me. It won't happen again. Stay with me. Don't leave me."
She smiled shakily.
"No, you don't understand. I'll be gone for a short while only."
She made an unmistakable gesture with the hands holding her torn skirt together.
"I won't be long."
His relief was almost pathetic.
"Oh, I understand. I'll make the chariot ready."
He turned to the horses, and she left him and picked her way deeper into the grove of thorn trees.